From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Former presidents and current lawmakers are remembering the late Representative John Lewis today at funeral services in Atlanta. Reverend Raphael Warnock spoke at the Ebenezer Baptist Church this morning.
We celebrate John Lewis. He was wounded for America's transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. So let's remember him today, and let's recommit tomorrow to standing together and fighting together and voting together and standing up on behalf of truth and righteousness together.
NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis joins us now. And Sue, what have people been saying today about John Lewis?
That he is an American hero, that his life and his work are directly related to creating a more just society, a more racially equitable society, and that his place in history will not be forgotten. One thing that he, his role in the Congress and one of his legacies that was mentioned today at his funeral is that it was his idea and his efforts that helped create the African American History Museum that's now on the Mall. And part of his life's work to not just stand for civil rights and to advance civil rights, but to make sure that the struggle towards civil rights never be forgotten.
There hasn't been a major funeral like this since the pandemic began, with three former presidents in attendance, Bush, Clinton, and Obama. What kind of precautions did they put in place? Not to mention there are dozens of members of Congress there.
Well, first, it was closed to the public and far less crowded than it would be in normal times. People seated 6 feet apart, everyone wearing masks, closed to the public, as I said, and just much more sparse. But I think that it was very important for all of these people, especially for members of Congress, especially for members of the African-American community, to give John Lewis a proper farewell. And this is the culmination of about a week of ceremonies honoring his life throughout Alabama, Washington, D.C., and now his hometown of Atlanta, where he will be buried.
And with all the attention rightly on John Lewis today, not a lot of action on the relief bill that is going through Congress at this point. How likely does it look like that there would be any kind of extension of, for example, unemployment benefits before they expire tomorrow?
They will expire. There will not be a deal before then. But I think we're in one of those situations where we've seen so often in this Congress and a divided Congress in the Trump administration where there's no deal in sight, but a deal is also still inevitable. Congress will have to come up with some kind of package to send to the president. But there is one of the great impasses on what to do with unemployment insurance. And I don't think there's anyone on Capitol Hill who doesn't think they have to do something. It's just not clear how they get there yet.
Sue, there was news today that Herman Cain, the former presidential candidate who attended President Trump's rally in Tulsa last month, died of COVID-19. And yesterday, Texas Representative Louis Gohmert tested positive for the disease after attending a hearing with Attorney General Bill Barr, who then had to be tested for COVID. Now House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is mandating masks in the House. Is this a turning point, do you think, for how seriously Congress will take the virus?
I think that the seriousness of which Congress has taken the virus is really the difference between the two parties. Democrats have taken this more seriously, Republican lawmakers less so. Anecdotally, we know from our own reporting and others that Republican offices, particularly on the House side, have been much more lax in their enforcement, not just of mask mandates, but in allowing people to do things like work from home or telecommute. Many lawmakers, like Louis Gohmert, were requiring their staff to come into the office and creating cultures where masks were not encouraged or enforced. Now, what Nancy Pelosi did was mandate masks be worn on the floor of the House, which she can do in her role as Speaker. It's much more complicated when you think about the Capitol complex. It's almost like a small town. It involves many in buildings across a complex, and even things like the botanical gardens are under the control. So members kind of control their own offices. If a member of Congress does not want staff to wear a mask, there's not much anybody else can do about it. So there is, we are seeing sort of the culture war in this country that has played out over this idea of whether to wear a mask or not is very much reflected on Capitol Hill. I will tell you that staff, lawmakers, the administrative staff that work up there, it's really roiling the Capitol right now, because I think Gohmert is showing how quickly you could have a potential outbreak on Capitol Hill and how many people could be affected by it simply by ignoring mask mandates.
I was going to ask you about one other thing, which is that President Trump tweeted today that the election should be delayed from November 3rd. But I'm not even going to ask because the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has now said it's set in stone on the 3rd. So that's probably a done deal. Sue Davis from NPR. Thank you.
You're welcome.
California and Florida continue to lead the nation with the highest number of people infected with the coronavirus, but Nevada has become one of the states with the most cases per capita. Researchers at George Washington University say Nevada is one of 11 states at risk of straining their supply of intensive care doctors, and that the health system needs to plan out staffing. Nevada's not expected to see a peak in cases until November. Celia Nieto has a view from the inside. She's a registered nurse at the intensive care unit at St. Rose Dominican Siena campus in Henderson, Nevada. She says there are not enough nurses to meet the demand.
In the ICU, a safe ratio is 2 patients to 1 nurse. We are dealing with patients whose conditions can change for the worst in 10 to 15 minutes. Right now, we are given assignments that are having us take care of 3 of those patients to 1. And with these really, really sick patients that we're seeing with COVID-19, they require, like I said, 10 to 15 minutes changes in medication, in drips, and we're not able to maintain that with our eyes on 3 patients.
So could you describe an incident, something that happened most recently, where you had a patient who needed attention, perhaps needed it immediately, and you felt as though you could not provide enough care?
The most recent instance that really affected me was when I had 3 patients critically ill, all on life support, being treated for COVID-19, and the family of one of my patients decided that they would withdraw life support and provide comfort care. And I've been doing this for 15 years, so end-of-life care is not new for me. But in this climate, it is. I'm used to looking into people's eyes, instructing them to hold their loved one's hand, sit with them, tell wonderful stories of this human being who's going to take their last moments, their last breaths. And I was pulled in the other direction, in addition to the family actually not being able to be there. We're on FaceTime, on phones, and I'm being pulled in my other direction and having to prioritize this care of too many patients. I felt like I fell short. I felt like I wasn't able to give that individualized, that compassionate care, hold this person's hand as they took their last breath, and their family wasn't allowed to be there with them either.
So you are not only the nurse looking after 3 patients, you are also representing the family of that one patient who is going to be taken or was being taken off life support. How did you prioritize that?
It's, you know, taking a deep breath. It's really hard, and I do the best I can.
Were you able to speak to him or her, saying the words the family wanted you to say?
I was, to the best of my ability. I just wish I could give it all the attention, you know, I feel that individual deserves, and not feel that nagging pull to my other 2 patients, and they deserve that attention too. They're someone's loved one too.
So given that, I wonder what you want the general public to understand, all of us to understand, what it's like to be a nurse during the pandemic.
You know, one of the things I'm still shocked that we are not as prepared in terms of with PPE and protection for our frontline healthcare workers.
Are you saying you're shocked that the medical system in general or your hospital in particular?
Both, and the government. As an organization and as nurses, we've been calling on President Trump to activate the Defense Production Act to produce more PPE to keep us safe so we can continue to do this.
Are we catching you, Celia, at the beginning of your shift or end of your shift today?
Neither. I am on a day off, thank goodness.
And you're speaking with us on your day off. We appreciate that. So let me just ask you, what keeps you sane on a day like today, your day off? What are you going to be doing?
I have found hobbies. I do a lot of puzzles. And I will probably swim with my family because it's so hot here in Nevada, high of 113. It's finding those things to let the stress melt off as much as we can. And believe it or not, speaking to you, it makes me feel like I'm doing something. It gives me, you know, a purpose.
Thank you, and we wish you the best. Celia Niento, registered nurse in the intensive care unit at St. Rose Dominican Siena campus in Henderson, Nevada, a suburb of Las Vegas. Good luck, Celia.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
We asked St. Rose Dominican hospitals for comment. A spokesperson says they're continuing to adapt operations as needed and that they're confident they have enough PPE for all staff.
On this day when the nation says goodbye to civil rights icon John Lewis, let's continue our conversation with David Lammy. He's a black member of the British Parliament who's worked on racial justice issues in his own country. His new book is called Tribes: How Our Need to Belong Can Make or Break Society. Here's the second part of our conversation. David Lammy, as you know, we've been going through quite a moment in this country, a movement following the death of George Floyd, and it's forced many to examine the lenses through which we see the world. Do you think that examination can help us better understand each other? In other words, can I ever really understand what life is like in your shoes and vice versa?
Well, look, if you believe in human dignity, if you understand that before the invention of scientific racism, the science that allowed Europeans to go out and colonize and enslave the world, of course there's a common humanity that means that empathy and compassion and whatever the color of our skin, we share so much more in terms of our genetics and our DNA. And I explore that at length in my book, Tribes. But I guess you have to dismantle the architecture that has been years and years in the making, and we're still on that painful journey. And, you know, what's, in a way, I'm uplifted by Black Lives Matter, because when I look at protests globally, whether in the United States, in Sydney, Australia, or in London, I see black and white young people saying enough is enough, and I see active allies. They may not be black, but they're active. They're using what they perceive to be their privilege to make a difference, and that inspires me. But I also worry, black pain, that gaze that settled on the dying man that was George Floyd, is so familiar. And in a sense, whilst the story is so often portrayed as being about black people, in my view, black people have been telling this story that is structural racism for hundreds of years. And the real question is not about blackness, it seems to me. It is a question about whiteness. It is a question about how majority communities finally not just don't just see, but act. And that's the opportunity that we have at the moment, that there is a sense that we have to act. And perhaps it is because of the current incumbent of the White House, the current incumbent of number 10 Downing Street, the current incumbent in Brasilia. It's perhaps because of these individuals that we've reached this critical point.
Well, on the issue of the majority community, many people have been examining their own maybe unconscious bias. And you write in this book that any suggestion of unconscious bias is too uncomfortable to consider, as it is interpreted as an allegation of direct, overt, and malevolent racism. That to be implicated in any form of racism is to have your overall moral integrity challenged. Has that made it more difficult, do you think, or will that make it more difficult for white people in these countries to come to terms with what has happened to black people and indigenous people in these countries?
Well, look, I am writing there about white fragility. And I say this married to a white woman, white family members, so I don't, you know, let me be clear about that. But I'm writing about the way in which, almost because of Luther King's call to look past color, can black children and white children sit down together? that there's this assumption, really, that the best state is to be colorblind. And of course, that is not what King was talking about. King was getting way beyond that, because being black is real for black people. It has consequences for black people. And so it's not about being colorblind. And it's not about individual acts of racism. It's about a system and a structure that is institutionalized, systemized, and is, I don't know, is so debilitating. So the, you know, you have to get past the fragility of, oh my God, that person just implied I was racist or called me racist, or, oh my God, what do you mean I've got unconscious bias? And let me tell you something from my point of view, from where I'm sitting here, that's not judgmental. It's me being honest about race. Mm-hmm. I remember when I came to America and I studied at Harvard Law School, and then I got a job in Silicon Valley. And when I went to work as a lawyer in Silicon Valley, it was the first time that I had ever met Native Americans. Mm-hmm. I had all these weird ideas from cowboy films. Deeply, deeply prejudiced tropes about what it meant to be a Native American. I brought that baggage to that law firm. And I needed to be seriously educated about what it meant to be Native American, right? I had to face my prejudices and my assumptions. I had to unlearn that crap that had crawled into my soul, right? And I had to get over my prickliness at being challenged for having prejudicial views, right? And that's work. And I had to do that work. Now, I may have been assisted because I had experienced prejudice, but no man, no black man wants to be called prejudiced and true. So what I'm saying is that was a system that put Native Americans at the bottom of the heap. And in a sense, you have to unlearn that stuff. And it's work. You have to do the work.
What do you think about reparations, whether it be monetary or just a public hearing of sort of the sins of the past, not just for the U.S., but for the United Kingdom as well?
The starting point is truth and reconciliation, as we saw in South Africa. Repairing the damage is about truth. It is about reconciliation. And when I say truth, it means that we're no longer in a society where we question notions like white privilege. We're no longer in a society where we say, look, systemized racism doesn't exist. And then we get to a point where we have to discuss power and reckoning and repairing. And that, to some extent, is obviously financial and involves endowments. I'm really, really pleased that here in the UK, we have universities like Cambridge University, Glasgow University, doing the work to understand their slave history and what they did and why they did it, and then thinking about, well, how do we move on from there?
Let me just finally ask you a couple of questions, and we'll call this a lightning round just to get through a couple of things that you bring up in this book, because you talk about the need for more people to be engaged in politics. Should voting be mandatory?
I actually believe it should be. People died to give us the vote. Yes, let's make it mandatory.
Do you think Brexit will actually happen at the end of this year? Not just on paper as it did a couple months ago, but all the details.
Yes, I think that Britain will be leaving the European Union, and it will be Boris Johnson that's the face of that departure. And that departure will hit the UK economy massively. And it comes at the same time as the post-pandemic economy. So the UK is going to be, in my estimation, in a very, very fragile place in the global community. And it's deeply, deeply worrying. But it is Boris Johnson that has delivered it, and he must be held to account for it.
Do you think it's possible that the UK would re-enter the European Union down the road?
I don't think in my lifetime the debate's been so scarring. But I think there's a reckoning. There's a reckoning for Britain in really coming to terms with you know, not being the country of empire and not being part of the European Union. Now, whether it becomes the 51st state of the United States of America, we will see. But some people think that is the only way that, frankly, this country can survive as we know it going forward. I haven't got a crystal ball. Let's see.
That would be pretty ironic. let me finally ask you.
The War of Independence comes full circle.
Exactly.
Guess who's going to lose out in that arrangement, by the way?
Right.
Because it ain't going to be our brothers and sisters in the States.
let me finally ask you, just going back to the issue of tribes. Many countries in the world right now are dealing with a rise of the far right, and also many are dealing with a rise of the far left. Where do you see the political winds blowing?
Well, in an age of deep inequality, where we're now going into a recession, depression for many economies, where we have largely unregulated social media, I'm afraid we will see extreme politics. There's no doubt about it. However, I do have a lot of faith in this younger generation who I do think get it. They get climate change. The problem is they're some way from the levers of power. They're still young, mm-hmm. right? Just look at the American election, look at the candidates, and look how old they are. So mm-hmm. we're in a bridging point. Let's see what happens in the November elections in the US. But it is a rocky period. We will get through it. And as one old-timer said to me, when we do get through it, my God, it's going to make the 1960s look tame.
That is David Lammy, a Labour Party member of the British Parliament. His new book is called Tribes: How Our Need to Belong Can Make or Break Society. David Lammy, it is always such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. So pleased to be with you.
The U.S. economy contracted by a record amount last quarter. GDP shrank at an annual rate of nearly 33%. The worst drop since the government started reporting the numbers. Unemployment claims also rose this week. This comes as the $600 federal unemployment benefit is set to expire tomorrow. NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley joins us now. Scott, this is the worst report we've seen in nearly a century. I know it doesn't sound it, but you say there is some nuance here. What is it?
Well, when you hear that figure that the GDP shrank at an annual rate of nearly 33%, you might think that the economy is a third smaller than it was before the pandemic, and that's not right. I don't want to minimize this. This is a really bad drop in GDP, but it's not that bad. The annualized figure is sort of projecting what would happen if we continued to drop at that rate for a full year. And we know that didn't happen. This was a very short-lived contraction. It was very abrupt, but it was short-lived. People lost jobs and stopped spending money in March and April as we battened down the hatches. And then we began to see a resumption of economic activity towards the end of the quarter in May and June. Now, of course, whether that recovery continues is in some doubt now because of the resurgence in infections.
Right. And unemployment claims rose for a second week in a row after this modest rebound when some states, as you said, reopened their economies. What does this turnaround indicate to you?
Well, it indicates that the recovery in the job market has stalled and maybe even moved into reverse. We saw good job gains in May and June. But in recent weeks, the new unemployment claims have sort of plateaued. There are other indications from timesheet companies and that sort of thing that suggest job gains have kind of stalled out as the coronavirus infections have increased. Now, we should say there's a special federal program that offers unemployment to gig workers and the self-employed who ordinarily are not eligible for unemployment. That dropped last week, so the overall number of people filing new claims actually went down. But it's a worrisome sign. We're not seeing the kind of improvements in the job market that we were seeing.
And the federal government's additional unemployment benefits run out tomorrow. Congress doesn't seem to be any closer on reaching a deal. So during the time people have been getting an extra $600 in their pocket, how much has that benefited the economy?
It's been huge. Both the supplemental unemployment benefits and the $1,200 payments that went out to most adults in the country played a huge role in propping up the economy during the second quarter. It's really remarkable when you look at this GDP report. As bad as it was, it could have been worse without that federal spending. We actually saw personal income in the aggregate go up during the quarter, even with those massive job losses, because the Congress was pouring so much money into the economy. When that $600 in supplemental unemployment insurance dries up, that's going to be a real hardship for a lot of families. It's also going to take a lot of wind out of sails of the economy, and it's going to hurt aggregate spending, which of course is the main driver of this economy. So it's really problematic, and it's hard to see Congress fumbling like this.
That's NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley.
Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has introduced a measure that would bar the military from using video games to recruit. It's been a key tactic for the military, which has not been able to recruit through more traditional venues like state fairs and school events because of coronavirus. Let's bring in Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Ben, first explain how the military uses video games to recruit.
Right. Well, I think it's important to say that in a lot of ways, the military has been soft recruiting via video games for a long time, right? From things like Call of Duty or Battlefield, Ghost Recon, even to games like Halo and Destiny, which are much more science fiction. All of these games are really part of what you might call the military entertainment complex, right? But the weird new wrinkle here is that the U.S. military has been experimenting with Twitch streams and esports. Twitch, if you remember, is sort of like a YouTube for video game streamers. It's owned by Amazon, and what people do is watch other people play video games on it. And that's not just for individual users. It's also a big business. That's called the esports. The Army has had an esports team. The Navy has one now. The Air Force has one. All of these teams of video game players include active duty members. And of course, you see a guy in the military playing a video game. That becomes a forum for a conversation about joining the military, almost like the table that you might set up at a career fair.
But the military right now is taking a pause on this to review its policies after they recently got into some First Amendment trouble. Explain what happened.
Right. If you're doing something on the internet that involves a social media platform, usually, which Twitch is because it allows conversation and chatting between gamers and audience and vice versa, some users were heading into the streams of the military to raise questions about war crimes being allegedly committed by the military. A very interesting form of trolling, to say the least. And when this trolling happened, the military banned certain commenters and kinds of comments from these streams. So, for instance, you couldn't use the phrase war crimes in the military's Twitch streaming channel. Another rule of the internet, of course, Jeremy, is the more you try to suppress and ban people for trolling you, often the more you get trolled. And this is what happened to the Army. Have you ever heard of the Streisand effect?
No.
It's this thing where Barbara Streisand, who we all know and love, tried to wipe pictures of her Malibu residence off of the internet. And the more that she tried to get rid of them, the more people loved to post them on the internet. That is called the Streisand effect. And that's what happened here, right? The military basically tried to ban this conversation from its channels. And the more they banned it, the more it happened.
And can they do that? Can they ban? I mean, the ACLU and others have been very upset about that.
Right. So I think part of the reason that the military is reviewing policies for these channels right now is that we don't really have a clear answer. But the Knight First Amendment Institute sent a letter to both the Army and the Navy recently calling for them to stop banning players, saying, quote, "The Army and Navy can't constitutionally delete comments or ban people from these Twitch channels simply for asking questions about issues they would rather not address." So I think it's a little bit of a debate right now.
Okay, so some issues to deal with right now, but assuming that they're able to pick this up again in some form, has it been successful, more successful in terms of recruitment than traditional methods?
Well, it has in some ways. And look, this is a case of meeting potential recruits where they already are, right? You're going to be more successful if you're trying to convince someone of something in an environment where they are comfortable and where they see you as part of the in crowd in that particular environment. Also, video games depicting warfare and war don't really deal with the real negative impacts of warfare and war, right? They might be violent, but they certainly don't take hard looks at, you know, what warfare does to communities, countries, individuals. Video games depicting war are entertainment. So not knowing more about the science of all of this, I'd say that those things are why it's more successful than traditional methods.
But aren't some of the people who are playing these games a little young to be recruited into the military?
Right. So there has been concern from politicians. You know, we have this recent amendment introduced to a funding bill from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, basically saying that the army is interacting with gamers as young as 13 and that that's predatory, especially during a pandemic when teenagers are feeling sort of extra desperate for money. And there was also a case of some of these military channels actually dropping links for contests to win gaming systems into some of these Twitch stream chats. But when you actually click on the link, it would bring you to a recruiting page. So there have been people kind of crying foul in terms of how the military is talking to individuals online in this way. They're reaching much younger people. We'll see where that nets out. I don't know if that amendment is going to move through Congress successfully, but it's certainly true that some politicians are starting to get concerned about this.
That is Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Ben, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, Texas, as we know, is currently a COVID hotspot, and those inside a federal immigrant detention center there are 8 times more likely to have COVID-19 than the general population. That's according to the latest stats from ICE and the Texas Department of State Health Services. Despite this, detainees say officials are failing to provide adequate social distancing and medical care. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval has the story.
I met up with Israel Rodriguez at a park just moments after he was released from the Joe Corley ICE facility north of Houston. He's 31 years old and wears a white t-shirt and the typical blue disposable medical mask. He describes the medical care he saw inside.
Honestly, yeah, especially like I had a friend from Burma and, you know, he was a pretty good guy. And he was in bed for 4 days and couldn't get out of bed. And he was coughing, he had a fever and chills. And, you know, he presented all the symptoms that experts talked about. But yeah, so he wasn't tested.
Rodriguez asked for testing after running a low-grade fever. He was denied. He asked again just before he was going to be released because he was planning to see his dad who has cancer. The nurse wouldn't test him.
What specifically told me that no, that ICE had told him that they should not test us, that they should refrain from doing so, and that it should only be done so in the most severe or, you know, a dramatic of cases. But as general testing or widespread testing, they said that that was not to happen.
That's Roger Ernesto Lao Munoz. He's inside that same facility and says he couldn't get tested either. He's from Cuba and studied hygiene and epidemiology. He told me the only time he saw people getting tested was when there were large clusters of cases or when people were about to be deported. At an ICE facility in El Paso, one detainee says she wasn't tested until she was bedridden. ICE says they've ramped up testing, and its numbers show that 20% of detainees test positive. The test positive rate for the general population in Texas is 12%. At the Houston Processing Center in North Houston, 124 people have tested positive, plus 32 staff. And if someone gets sick, one detainee there says they don't do anything for us. They don't even give us pills for headaches. We're not using the detainee's name to avoid possible retaliation. He says staff did test people in his 30-person dorm, and as people tested positive, guards would shuffle them into another room in groups.
No puedo respirar bien. Como que me canso más.
He says even though he's recovered, he still can't breathe well and gets tired quickly. ICE says it's taken precautions to slow the spread. It's given multiple masks to each detainee, and it's released more than half of the detained population in Texas. In a statement, ICE said it complies with CDC testing guidelines, adding that detainees with COVID-19 symptoms are checked out by a medical professional who decides whether or not to test them. ICE also says it offers voluntary testing at some facilities. But for those still inside, social distancing seems to be impossible. One woman in the El Paso facility, who asked to remain anonymous, recalled guards' orders about sleeping arrangements in the dorms.
They just made us rotate our heads. Like the person that was on top would have their head on the left, and then the girl on the bottom would have her head on the right. That was the social distancing.
Julie Posh is an immigration lawyer in Houston and says the public needs to put more pressure on ICE to release everyone they possibly can.
The single most important thing they need to be doing is releasing people. that is the best way to stop the spread of this virus in the detention centers, is to get people out of the detention centers so they can quarantine at home with their families, with relatives, with wherever they may be able to live with.
Posh says most of the people inside these facilities don't have serious criminal records. And even though ICE has released thousands of detainees, in Texas, more than 5,000 people are still in immigration lockup. They're among the most vulnerable in the state to the disease. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Crowell.
It didn't take long for COVID-19 to affect Major League Baseball. Games with the Miami Marlins are suspended through this weekend after more than a dozen players and coaches tested positive for COVID-19. The Marlins played in Philadelphia last weekend, even though Miami knew some on their team were infected. The Phillies also postponed some games this week in case the Marlins exposed them to the virus. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, does this surprise anybody in Major League Baseball?
Well, I think it surprised Rob Manfred, who is the commissioner of baseball. Now, to be fair, in his very rare public comments, he said, "We always knew something like this could happen," but it was clear he had no plan for it. So there are now actually closer to 24 than a dozen Marlin players who were infected. And if you go over the timeline of why they're not playing and why they did play, it was that the Marlins took a team vote to play, even though there were infected players on the team. Like, how is that important? How is that part of the protocol? They did play, thereby possibly spreading the infection to others. And then the reason they're not playing now, officially, MLB said, okay, the Marlins will be off for 2 days. But another team, the Washington Nationals, they took a vote and said, no, we won't be traveling down to the infected area to play the Marlins. So it seems extremely ad hoc. And beyond that, the communication about it has just been an abyss. So if something like this happens again, if there is another outbreak of this nature, I don't know what baseball's going to do. Play it by ear. So, let them play unless a team takes a vote. Big question marks.
And the Phillies, how much was known about the vote that the Marlins took and that some were infected? I mean, did the Phillies have a say in this?
No, the Phillies were to occupy locker rooms the Phillies played the Marlins, and then the Yankees were to occupy locker rooms, or as they call them, clubhouses. So there was a cascade of four teams whose schedule was halted. And inside the world of baseball, the big question is, oh, how do they make up the games? I really do think that's the wrong question. Baseball issued hundreds and hundreds of protocols, including no spitting, which is being ignored, no high fives. I got to tell you, I've watched every Met game, seen every Met score. There has been high five after everyone, but no protocols for what happens when there's a massive outbreak and a team turns into a hot spot. Just kind of crazy, if you ask me.
Is there any way that there's going to be an already abbreviated 60-game schedule for Major League Baseball?
Yes, because, well, the 60-game schedule is so tight that it's probably going to be hard for the Marlins, maybe the Orioles, to get all their games in. So if this goes on and there aren't too many pauses in play, there might be some teams might play fewer games, and they might go to the team's winning percentage as opposed to just the wins and losses to see who makes the playoffs, though the playoffs are expanded. So a lot more teams will be making the playoffs this year than last year, if there are indeed a playoffs.
And how about basketball? The NBA season resumes tonight after it was shut down since March. Has the NBA had any coronavirus issues so far?
Well, yes, individual players have issues, but they are in a bubble, just like Major League Soccer, just like the WNBA. And I understand it's harder for teams with big or sports with big rosters like baseball and football to bubble up. But the difference between a bubble where your interactions are controlled and a non-bubble is sort of the difference between a NASA space rocket launch and someone shooting off a bottle rocket in their backyard. I mean, basketball has controlled and has protocols, and all the players have wrist bracelets that beep them in and out of areas they're supposed to be into, and they also contact trace as they go along. So they've been doing it much more formally, much more rigorously, and the season's going to start today, tonight, a full slate of games Friday. They seem to be poised to do this successfully.
The WNBA resumed play last Saturday, the women players. How's that going so far?
it's going really well. I mean, all the stories from the WNBA are things like great players like Breonna Stewart, a former MVP, returning. She missed all of last year with an injury. She's been great. The number one draft pick, Sabrina Ionescu of the New York Liberty, scored 33 points. She looks great. And the other stories, if they're not basketball, are about activism, are about Kyrie Irving, the NBA star, donating $1.5 million to WNBA players who couldn't play or didn't feel comfortable playing. So far, that experiment's going quite well.
The National Women's Soccer League was the first American pro league to return to play. The league just completed its 2020 Challenge Cup. Houston Dash won the title. There were no positive coronavirus cases during the competition. So is there a lesson there for everybody else?
Yes. And MLS seems to be going well, too, which is the men's version. That bubbles seem to work and non-bubbles are extremely dangerous. I would say that is the lesson to take away.
Okay, one final question. NFL training camps are opening. Some players are opting out of play because of the virus. Is it going to be possible to play football safely this year?
I think it's going to be possible to play football just like it's going to be possible to open schools or open restaurants. We just have to wait and see what the virus is doing. The NFL right now is not doing a bubble. I guess they can't do a bubble, but there are players who are saying, I don't feel comfortable. Many players on the Patriots. I just think non-bubble sports are going to be a tough ask in this environment.
Okay. Mike Pesca, thank you. Mike Pesca is host of the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.